I want to begin in volume 12, May the 24th, 1920. The acts done in the divine will be the defenders of the divine throne, not only in the present time, but in all the future centuries as well. So Jesus said to Louisa, "My daughter, the acts done in my will leave the human acts behind, and identifying themselves with my divine acts, they rise up even into heaven. They circulate in everyone. They embrace all centuries, all points, and all creatures. And since they remain fixed in my will, these acts are and will be the defenders of my throne for each offence which creatures give to me. And not only in the present time, but until the end of centuries." There's a wonderful message of Jesus that the acts that we do will continue to operate throughout the whole of history. And so it is very important for us to keep the acts going. "And rising to my defence, they will make the reparations counter to the offences that creatures will give me. And acts done in my will have the power of multiplying themselves according to the need and to the circumstances which my glory requires. Therefore, they cover everything and they cover all needs. What will be the happiness of the soul when she finds herself up there in heaven and sees her acts done in my will as defenders of my throne, which, having a continuous echo of reparation, will reject the echo of the offences that come from the earth?" That's a wonderful, wonderful image that, you know, even when we are in heaven, that our acts will still be like a huge bulwark against the offences that are coming from the earth and will continue to make reparation forever. I think it's incredible. It's a most wonderful privilege. "Therefore, for the soul who lives in my will on earth, her glory in heaven will be different from that of the other blessed because she has done all this on earth. The others will draw all their contentment from me, while these souls will not only draw them from me, but will have their own little rivers within my own sea. Since by living in my volition, they themselves formed them on earth within my sea." I want to give you 1 Corinthians 3:11-15, where St. Paul says quite clearly that while we are on the earth, that we can make for ourselves a tent or a palace in heaven, and we can make it of wood or straw or gold and silver and diamonds. And the gold and silver and diamonds are these wonderful acts in the divine will. Jesus continues, "It is right that they have the little rivers of happiness and of contentment in heaven. Oh, how beautiful are these rivers within my sea." Everything is within God. You can't be outside of him. "They pour into me and I into them. It will be an enchanting sight at which all the blessed will remain astounded." So I want to give you Revelation 22:2, the trees of life growing by the river of life. And John 7:37-39, that out of your own heart will flow fountains of living water. May 28th, 1920 continues speaking about the acts in the divine will. Louisa said, "I was offering myself in the holy sacrifice of the Mass together with Jesus so that I too might undergo the same consecration as him. And he moving in my interior," which of course is Luke 17:21. And 1 Corinthians 3:16. He told me, "My daughter, enter into my will so that you may find yourself in the hosts, in all of the hosts." not only in the present, but also in the future. And in this way, you will undergo together with me as many consecrations as I undergo. In each host, I place one life of mine, and I want another one in return. But how many do not give it to me? Others receive me. I give myself to them, but they do not give themselves to me. In other words, it's not communion. If you take your two hands together and let the fingers intertwine, communion is you in me and I in you. I give myself to you, you give yourself to me. That's communion. And for many people, they will receive Jesus physically, but they won't give themselves to him. So it's not communion. I give myself to them, but they do not give themselves to me. And my love remains suffering, hampered, and suffocated, and without requital. Therefore, in my will, come to undergo all the consecrations which I undergo, and I will find in each host the requital of your life. And not only for as long as you remain on the earth, but also when you are in heaven. In fact, since you have been consecrated in advance, while being in my will on the earth, just as I undergo consecrations until the end, so will you undergo them. And I will find unto the last day the requital of your life. So here the Lord is telling us that if we enter into his divine will, and if we give ourselves to him, because this started off with Louisa saying, I was offering myself to Jesus in the holy sacrifice of the Mass so that I could undergo the same consecration. So Jesus says, yeah, enter into his divine will. It's presuming now that you are living there in the divine will and that you give yourself fully to him. He gives himself fully to you. And you are consecrated with him for all time. Then he said, the acts done in my will are always those which excel over all and have supremacy over everything. In fact, having been done in my will, they enter into the sphere of eternity because they're done on the divine level. And taking the first places in it, they leave all human acts behind, running always ahead. Because if you enter into the sphere of eternity, you've left time and space, and you've entered into eternity. You're outside of time and space. So these acts leave all human acts behind, nor can whether they are done before or after have any influence, whether it's one era or another, or whether they are small or great. You see, God lives in that singularity, in that single point. So past and future don't exist. Everything is present now. So it doesn't matter whether you did these acts in the 20th century or the 30th century. It doesn't actually matter. They're all present now, and they're all in act now. So it doesn't matter whether it's in one era or another, or whether they are small or great. It's enough that they're done in my will. So if they are done in my will, they will always be the first and they will always run ahead of human acts. Let's take an example of oil. If you place oil together with other edibles, if you place oil together with other edibles, even of greater value, even gold and silver are foods of great substance, they all remain underneath and the oil excels on top of them all. It never lowers itself to be underneath. Be it even in minimal quantity, with this little mirror of light, it seems to say, I'm here to excel over everything. nor do I band together with other things or blend with them. In the same way, the acts done in my will, because they are done in my will, these acts become light because God is light. So they do not mix with human acts. Rather, they have the power of making the human acts turn into divine. That's the glory that's being offered to us. Therefore, they leave everything behind, and while they are the first of all. So our acts done in the divine will become divine, therefore become light, and God is light. I want to give you John 1, 1 to 4, and 2 Timothy 6, 16, because God dwells in inaccessible light. So June the 2nd, 1920, Jesus felt the pain of the separation which man had caused with sin. Continuing in my usual state and recollecting myself in prayer, I saw an abyss within me, of which I could not see the bottom. And in the middle of this abyss of depth and width, my sweet Jesus, afflicted and taciturn. I could not understand how I saw him in me, and I felt far away from him, as if he did not exist for me. My heart remained tortured, and I felt the torment of a cruel death. And this not once, but who knows how many times, that I find myself in this abyss as though separated from all and from my all as well. Now, while my heart was literally dripping blood, my beloved Jesus, coming out of this abyss, surrounded my neck with his arms and placing himself behind my shoulders, told me. So that image of Jesus surrounding Louisa's neck with his arms is Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 6. His left arm is under my head and his right arm is embracing me, is what the Song of Songs says. And so Jesus said, my beloved daughter, you are my true portrait. In other words, she is an image of him. Her life is an image of him. And that's what he's been asking since volume one. So I want to give you Romans 8:29 there. He said, oh, how many times my moaning humanity found itself in these tortures. It was identified with the divinity even more. There were one single thing, because Jesus had the hypostatic union. And while they were one, I still felt the torment of the separation of the abyss of the divinity, because while it enveloped me inside and outside, and I being identified with it, I still felt it far away. My poor humanity was to pay the penalty of the separation which abusing humanity had caused with sin. And in order to join it to the divinity, I was to suffer all the pain of their separation. In other words, Jesus had to experience our hell. So I want to give you Psalm 22, verse 1, and Matthew 27, 47. My God, why have you abandoned me? And so Louisa is here participating in this same awesome mystery that Jesus experienced himself while he was on the earth. That if she is to be consecrated with him in all the hosts, the other side of that is that she will experience with him the frightening price that he had to pay for our salvation. And so Jesus said, I had to suffer all the pain of their separation from the divinity. Of course, that's hell. But each instant of separation was for me a ruthless death. Because he had known the absolute, total, extraordinary happiness, joy, and peace of the divinity, of course, in heaven. So here on earth, even though the divinity is within him, he, because he is the mediator between God and man, has taken on the price of our salvation. So he experiences hell for us. There's a wonderful moment in the hours of the Passion when Jesus is standing before the people waiting for their condemnation. And he explains to Louisa, it's either my death or hell for humanity, one or the other. So he had to take on our hell and pay for it with his death as well. And Jesus said to her, this is the cause of your pains and of the abyss that you see. It is likeness to me. Also in these stormy times, it's 1920, so it's after the First World War, and Jesus still calls them stormy times because communism and atheistic materialism is having an absolutely devastating effect on the world. Also in these stormy times, humanity runs away from me as though in a reckless flight. And you must feel the pain of the separation in order to be able to join them to me. In other words, you've got to enter in, participate, if you're to do the work of the victim soul of joining them to God. It's true that your state is very painful, but it is always a pain of your Jesus. In other words, it's redemptive pain. This is not the pain of somebody who is themselves in trouble. And I, in order to give you strength, will hold you tightly from behind your shoulders so that while keeping you safer, I will give greater intensity to your pain. My only reaction to that is, wow. We always want less pain. And he says that he would give greater intensity to Louise's pain. In fact, if I kept you in front of me by merely seeing my arms close to you, your pain would be halved and my likeness would be achieved later. So the likeness to Christ is not only the love, joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and all the rest of it. It's not just that. It's also the likeness to him as the Redeemer, as the Mediator, as the one who paid the price. So I want to give you 1 Peter 1:3-10 there. June 10, 1920. The humanity of our Lord lived suspended in the air. Louisa said, I was feeling very afflicted and all alone, without support from anyone, and my sweet Jesus clasped me, lifting me up into the air. And he said, my daughter, when my humanity lived on the earth, it lives suspended halfway between heaven and earth. I want to give you Isaiah 58:12. Having all the earth beneath me and heaven above me, and by living in this way, I tried to draw all the earth into myself and all heaven, and to make them united, one single thing. Now, the emphasis that Jesus has given us in all of these messages in volume 12 is that we have to live up high, like the eagle at the very top of the mountains, and you don't get involved in what is going on down below, in all the noise and all the hassle and all the violence and all the sin and all the rest of it. You don't get involved in that. Well, because you live up high, you're therefore suspended between heaven and earth. And therefore, you can give glory to God on behalf of them all down below at one. So you do two things. You give glory to God on behalf of them all down below, and you also try and bring the ones who are down below up into the place where you are, so that they too can be united with God. And so you have a great mission for saving souls. And this is the reason for this expression of being suspended in the air. Because while you're still on the earth, you can't identify with people on this very low level, and you can't yet rise and be permanently in heaven either. So you're suspended between one and the other. So Jesus said, if I had wanted to live at the earth's level, that's down below, I could not have drawn anything into myself, only a few points at the most. I had no place on which to lean, nor anyone on which to lean. And only the things of strict necessity were given to my humanity. So I want to give you Luke 9:58. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And while we know that text, we never really understood. We just thought that Jesus didn't have a house and an address. Well, he's saying there was literally nowhere for the divinity to rest on the earth. Our Blessed Mother was the only place where Jesus could truly rest, because she was living in the divine will. And only the things of strict necessity were given to my humanity. As for the rest, I was always alone and without any comfort. However, this was necessary. First, because of the nobility of my person, to whom it did not befit living down below. So any of us living in the divine will, it's not fitting that we would get involved in worldly things. You're not there anymore. You have risen to a very high place with the Lord, and you must live as befitting the place where you are. It did not befit my person living down below with vile and faulty human supports. Then, because of the great office of redemption that I had, which had to have supremacy over everything, it was not fitting to live down below either. So Jesus, while he was serving the human race to maximum extent, he couldn't be at their level. Because if you yourself are dying of cancer, can you help anybody else who's dying of cancer? The answer is no. The person who can help the person dying of cancer is the one who is well. They're in a different place. And so Jesus had the office of Redeemer as well, and that isolated him totally. Therefore, it befitted me to live up high, above everyone. This is at the highest level of his being. And so there had to be that separation between himself and everybody else. And you could see this even in his relationship with the apostles. Most of the time they didn't understand him and didn't understand why he did things. They didn't understand his reasons for doing things. Now, one whom I call to my likeness, that's Romans 8:29, I place in the same conditions in which I place my own humanity. Therefore, I myself am your prop, my own arms are your support, and I will make you live in my arms suspended in the air, and only the things of strict necessity can reach you. That's Deuteronomy 32:12. The Lord alone was his guide. For one who lives in my will, so now we're talking about people not just doing little acts in the divine will, but actually living 100% in the divine will, detached from everyone, all for me. Anything more than strict necessities are vile things and a degrading of herself and her nobility. So you just have to understand who you are. And if human supports are given to her, she senses the stench of the human, and she herself drives them away. It's very interesting. The stench of the human is that human beings can do good. They can do apparently very good things, but you could see the faulty motivation. And you could see their need for glory and for praise and for this, that and the other. The stench of the human. And so right from the very beginning of the church, so many of the saints have gone out into deserts and have gone into monasteries and convents in order to be away from the maddening crowd and to try and be able to give their lives to God. Then Jesus added, "As soon as the soul enters into my will, her will remains bound within the eternal will." This is what I call locking your will into his will. And once that locking happens, it's permanent. So after that, then you're dealing with the living in the divine will, because your will is locked into his. Her will remains bound within my eternal will. And even if she does not think about it, since her will has been bound to mine, whatever my will does, hers does as well. And together with me, she runs for the good of all. So that means no matter what the movement is, interior or exterior, it is running for the good of all, because the two wills are locked together. So June the 22nd, 1920, the sanctity of the humanity of Jesus was complete absence of self-interest. And this is the standard that is raised for us who want to live in the divine will. This is June the 22nd, 1920. "I was bringing the whole human family to my sweet Jesus, according to my usual way, praying, repairing, substituting in the name of all. And I was doing this for all that each one was obliged to do to God. But while I was doing this, a thought came to me. Think and pray for yourself. Don't you see what a pitiful state you've reduced yourself to?" Now, this is the temptation that comes back to her every now and then. And while it may seem strange to us studying her work, and that this is deep into volume 12, you must understand that she was the first to move away from ordinary Christianity. And therefore, all the priests around her would only understand that she should be looking out for her own salvation as well. She said, "I was almost about to do it." I love the little word "almost." She wasn't allowed because her will is locked into his. "My sweet Jesus, moving in my interior, pulling me to himself, told me, 'My daughter, why do you want to move away from my likeness? What is this business that's pulling you away? I never thought about myself. The sanctity of my humanity was complete absence of self-interest. We're not in the divine will mission in order to become holier than anybody else. I couldn't imagine myself holier than anything. Because St. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that it's the weak things of this world that the Lord chooses to confound the strong. And he tells us to stay in our nothingness. So how can you be important? So how can you have this self-interest? We're the little ones that the Lord says that the king wants to send a large sum of money to another country, and he wouldn't give it to somebody important because they could be attacked by robbers. But he gives it to somebody of absolute unimportance. And nobody, including the individual themselves, would think that God would do that with them, or that the king would do it with them. And so they managed to get the large sum of money to another country safely. It's the complete absence of self-interest. He said, "I did nothing for myself." If you read the works of Maria Valtorta, you will see this clearly. And you will see that in the relationship between Peter and Jesus that Peter was very paternal towards Jesus. He was much older than him. And that many times he said to the other apostles, you better take care of him. He won't take care of himself. He won't look after his own needs. You've got to make sure that he has food and he's got this, that and the other. Jesus said, I did nothing for myself, but I did, and I suffered everything for others. My love can be called true because it is marked by disinterest for my own self. Wherever there is self-interest, it cannot be said that there is the fount of truth. And don't forget that Jesus is truth. That's John 14:6. I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. So if this is the way Jesus lived in the divine will, that has to be the way that we live in the divine will also. On the other hand, the soul with no self-interest is the one who comes forward the quickest. And as she comes forward, the sea of my grace takes her from behind, inundating her in such a way as to make her remain completely submerged without her even thinking about it. On the contrary, one who thinks about herself is last. So you can choose for yourself whether you want to be first or last. The sea of my grace is in front of her, and she's the one who has to cross it by her own arm strokes, if she manages at all. In fact, the thought of herself will create many obstacles for her, such as to strike into her the fear of diving into my sea, and she runs the risk of remaining on the shore. And this is actually a very important reflection, because if you think too much about it, you won't do something. You're like the person on the diving board, and you look down and you think about the depth that you're going to jump. And the more you think about it, the less you'll jump. The person who will be a successful diver is the one who will get onto the platform and jump, trusting, hopefully, in God, not just themselves. And if we're to lock ourselves into the divine will, it's better to just simply do it. Don't think about it so much. That's why I'm against doing a 9-day novena to get the grace to surrender. Just do it. Just jump. Because you're jumping into the everlasting arms. And you're giving God great glory. So just do it. Don't wait. The more you think about it, the more reasons you can find for not doing it today. Tomorrow. You'll do it tomorrow. That was the problem that St. Augustine had. Lord, convert me, but not today. Not today. And then the not today went on for years. And his poor mother had to do extraordinary penance so that one day it was today. If you are reading this, it's not today, it's now, it's this moment. It is as I speak. Just say, Lord, do it. September 2nd, 1920. The martyrdom of love and the pain for Jesus because of the lack of the company of the creature. I live amid almost continuous privations, Louisa said. At the most, my sweet Jesus makes himself seen and escapes me like a flash. But only he knows the martyrdom of my poor heart. Now, as I was thinking about the love with which he suffered so much for us, he told me, my daughter, my first martyrdom was love. And love gave birth for me to the second martyrdom, which is pain. each pain was preceded by immense seas of love. But when love saw itself alone, abandoned by the majority of creatures, I raved, I agonized, and since my love could find no one to whom to give itself, it concentrated within me, drowning me and giving me such pain that all other pains seemed a refreshment compared to these. If I had had company in love, I would feel happy. Because with company, all things acquire happiness, they diffuse, they multiply. Love close to another love is happy, be it even a small love, because it finds one to whom it can give itself, one to whom it can make itself known, one to whom it can give life with its own life. Now, when you go to the agony of Jesus in Gethsemane in the hours of the Passion, you will find what he's talking about here very much reflected there. And this agony that Jesus went through because he was all abandoned by everybody, that there was no love given back to him. And you have Louisa travelling around the whole world, taking his precious blood to everybody so that she can bring souls back to him. God is looking for our love. Why is that? Is it because he's lacking something? The answer is no. It is, as John of the Cross says, love can be repaid by love alone. And also that love lives by giving. Giving all. Now, God has put this mystery of love into the sacrament of marriage, in which a man and a woman come together in love, giving themselves completely to each other, so that love can give birth to another life. And this other life is the image of their love. And this other life, whom we call a child, as it grows, it gives back love to the two that originated its life. And therefore the cycle of life, of love, is complete. But if the child never gives love back, then the cycle of love is not complete and the agony of the parents begins. Any mother will tell you the sheer joy she has when Any mother will tell you the sheer joy she has when the first time an infant looks up from the breast and recognises a person behind the food, and the little hand goes up to touch the mother's face. That's a moment of ecstasy for the two. Love has found love, and love has been responding to love, or love begins to respond to love. And so spiritually, that is why Jesus tells us here that the only motivation he accepts is love. Doing something because you absolutely have to is like a slave. Doing something simply because it's God's will and you're ordered to do it, that's the position of a servant or a slave. Doing it out of love is the position of a child. I learned this when I was very small. And my family, large family, living in a tiny house. And my mother asked me to tidy the house. And I couldn't even imagine where you would begin. And I just looked at it in total distress. And she said, what do you think of me? She said. And I said, I think you're the greatest mummy on earth. She was. And she said, if you want to prove it, she said, do what I asked. Because she said, love is proved by actions, not words. That was a very wise thing to say to a small girl. And so the thing that I found impossible, which was to even start tidying the house, was then possible because I was doing it for my mummy. And I was doing it to tell her that I loved her. this is exactly what Jesus tells us in these writings, that no matter what it is that we have to do, the motivation is that we do it because we love him. And therefore, even very difficult things like laying down your life becomes easy. So love, which is close to another love, is happy, even if it is a small love, because it finds one to whom it can give itself, one to whom it can make itself known, one to whom it can give the life of its own love. But when it is close to one who does not love it, who despises it, who does not care about it, it's quite unhappy. It's the same at home as well, isn't it? Because it does not find the way to communicate itself and to give life. Beauty close to ugliness is the same thing. It feels dishonored. And it seems that they shun each other. Because what is beautiful hates ugliness. And ugliness feels uglier when it's close to beauty. But what is beautiful close to another thing that is beautiful is happy. And they communicate their beauty to each other. Same for everything else. What good is it for the teacher to be learned and to have studied so much if he finds no pupil to whom to teach? Oh, how unhappy he is not finding anyone to whom to teach so much doctrine. What good is it for a doctor to have understood the art of medicine if there's no sick person calling him to display his ability? What good is it for a rich person to be rich if there's no one to approach him? And he remains alone in spite of his riches, not finding the way to make them known and to communicate them to someone. This one would probably die of starvation. Only company makes everyone happy. Love must find love. Life must find life. Joy must find joy. Beauty must find beauty. Purity must find purity. And so on. I want to give you Proverbs 8:31. The Lord delights to be with the children of men. Only company is what makes everyone happy. It allows good to be carried out and makes it grow. Isolation makes everything unhappy and sterile. Ah, my daughter. Oh, how my love suffers this isolation. And those few who keep me company, that is, living with the Lord in a spiritual life and living in adoration and praise and love, form my refreshment and my happiness on earth, of course, because he's eternally happy in heaven. And so the Lord wants us with him. Now, when you go to Mark chapter 3, you have the choosing of the apostles, and the extraordinary thing that Mark tells us that the other gospels don't tell us is that Jesus chose the 12 so that they would be with him, that they would be his companions. He didn't want to be alone on this mission that he was setting out to do. September the 21st, 1920, the acts done in the divine will remain confirmed in the divine will. Jesus spoke to Louisa, "My daughter, as the soul does her acts in my will, her act remains confirmed in my will. That is, if she prays in my will, remaining confirmed in my will, she receives the life of prayer in such a way that she no longer needs an effort in order to pray, but will feel within herself the spontaneous promptness in praying." Romans 8:28. The Holy Spirit comes to help us in our weakness. In fact, remaining confirmed in my will, she will feel within herself the fount of the life of prayer, almost like a healthy eye that makes no effort in seeing, but naturally looks at objects it delights, it enjoys them, because it contains the life of light within the eye. But a sick eye, how many strains there are, and what it suffers in looking. In the same way, if she suffers in my will, if she operates, she will feel within herself the life of patience, the life of operating in a saintly way. So, as her acts remain confirmed in my will, they lose weakness and misery and what is human, and they remain substituted by founts of divine life. That only requires you to meditate on it. September the 25th, 1920, the truth is light. Now we know that God is light. We know that love is light, because love is God. And now the truth is light. The truth is God. John 14, 6 and 1 John 1, 5. Finding myself in my usual state, I saw my beloved Jesus as if he were placing a globe of light in my interior. Now we're going to discover further down that this globe of light contained the truths of the divine will. I don't know if you've read the story of Blessed Anna Maria Teige, who lived at the time of Napoleon, and she lived in a tiny hovel within walking distance of the Vatican. And she had an absolutely extraordinary gift. She was the one who made Napoleon's mother into a saint by getting her to make reparation for her son's actions. The Lord gave Anna Maria a globe of light, and people came to her from all walks of life. Bishops, priests, cardinals, princes, kings, absolutely extraordinary, came to this tiny hovel looking to this very poor woman, looking for light, that is enlightenment. What is God saying? And she only had to look into this globe of light, and she could tell them their future. She could tell them exactly what God wanted to say to them. Now, the future of the human race is in this globe of light that the Lord is giving to Louisa, because it contains the truths of the divine will. And Jesus said, "My daughter, my truth is light." And in communicating the truths to souls, since they are limited beings, I communicate my truths within limited light. Since they're not capable of receiving the immense light, naturally enough, because it's divine and immeasurable. However, it's the same as with the sun. While up high in the heavens, one sees a globe of light, limited, circumscribed. The light that spreads from it invests the whole earth. It warms the whole earth. It fertilizes the whole earth. And so it's impossible for man to number the plants that are fertilized and the lands that are illuminated and warmed by the sun. So while man can see the sun up high in the heavens in the twinkling of an eye, he cannot see where the light ends, and he can't understand the good that the light does. It's the same that thing that happens to the sons of the truths. Now notice, in these writings, the word son is given as an image of God, it's given as an image of divine will, it's given an image of the acts done in the divine will, and here now the Son is also given as an image of the truths of the divine will. So the same image covers so many things. Now, therefore, you just have to remember, what is the Son? It's a source of light, heat, life, fertilizing for the earth, warmth, joy, everything for us. So you're being told, therefore, that the Son of the truths, it contains everything that we actually need for living in the divine will. So the same happens to the truths, the sons of the truths, which I communicate to souls. inside of them, they appear as limited. But when these truths come out, how many hearts do they not strike? How many minds do they not illuminate? How much good do they not do? And this is why you saw me place a globe of light inside of you. These are my truths that I communicate to you. Notice they come from God. Therefore, they are divine truth. These are my truths. They come from God. Be attentive in receiving them, more attentive in communicating them, to give course to the light of my truths. To give course is to make way for them to spread. So I want to give you Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. Now, returning to pray, Louisa said, I found myself in the arms of my celestial mother, who, squeezing me to her breast, was caressing me. But then, I don't know how, I forgot about this and I was lamenting that everyone had left me, which is a contradiction in terms, of course. And Jesus, passing by, briefly said, just a little while ago, my mother was here and she squeezed you in her arms with great love. And Louisa said, and as he said it, I remembered. The same happens with me, he said. How many times I come and you forget about it? Could I perhaps be without coming? On the contrary, I act like a mother. When her child sleeps, she kisses her, caresses her, and the child does not know anything about it. And when she wakes up, she laments that her mother does not kiss her and doesn't give her any love. He said, that's what you do. Now, we've had that for 12 volumes. Does the Lord know us very well? Absolutely. Psalm 139, he knows my thoughts before I think them and my words before I say them. This knowledge is too great for me. So, October the 12th, 1920. For one who lives in the divine will, her help is Jesus alone. Now, we have to remember this. Deuteronomy 32, 12. The Lord alone is her guide. If you're going to live in the divine will and you think that the priests in the parish or anybody else who's not living in the divine will can actually guide you, forget about it. They won't even know what you're talking about. I was feeling very oppressed, all alone. Notice that this comes immediately after Jesus saying to her, I'm like a mother who comes and kisses you quietly while you're sleeping. And when you wake up, you say, I don't do it at all. And she said, without even the hope of receiving a word of reassurance. So Psalm 73, verses 25 and 26. Be it even holy people, it seems to me that if they come to me, they want help, they want comforts, or to rid themselves of doubts. But for me, there's nothing. So while I was in this state, Jesus told me, my daughter, one who lives in my will is placed in the same condition as I was in on the earth. Suppose that I might have need of creatures, which cannot be. Such creatures are not capable of being of any help to their creator. Naturally. It would be as if the sun wanted to ask for light and heat from the other created things that need the light and the heat from the sun. What would they say? They'd all draw back confused and they'd say, what? You're asking for light and heat from us? You who fill the whole world with light and you who fertilize the whole earth with your heat? Our light disappears before you. You rather give us light and heat, that's your job. So, it happens to one in the divine will. It's the same thing that happens to someone living in the divine will. They are placed in the same condition as me, Jesus said. And the son of my volition, being in her, she is the one who must give light, warmth, help, reassurance, and comfort to everybody else. So, I alone am your help, Deuteronomy 32:12. And you from within my will go and help others. You see, if we've understood anything that's in these writings, then everything is in the divine will, absolutely everything. All you've got to do is let your will be locked into the divine will, stay there 24/7, 365, everything is in the divine will, and you yourself will be a source of light and grace and help to others. November the 15th, 1920. Continuous good makes it so that the creature feels transported to operate good. Louisa said, "My state is ever more painful. The most holy will alone is my only help." That's exactly what we've just finished with in the last message. Jesus said, "My daughter, each work done for me, whether it is a thought, a word, a prayer, a suffering, or even a simple memory of me, are many chains which the soul keeps forming in order to bind me and to bind herself to me." Now, every act we do in the divine will binds the Lord to us and binds us to him. And these chains, without using violence to the human freedom, because God will never, ever do that, he's the only one who won't violate your freedom, they have the power of sweetly administering to her the chain of perseverance, causing the final link and the final step to be formed as to make her take possession of immortal glory. Look at that. Every act binds us to him and binds him to us. And the more you do, the more chains there are binding us together. And you can see that if someone is absolutely chained and chained and chained and chained and chained and chained and chained, it'll be like that on your final act as well. And you will be transformed into immortal glory. In fact, continuous good has such power, such attraction over the soul, that without anyone forcing her or using violence on her, voluntarily, she feels transported to operate good. So the more good we do, the more that is the river that you're swimming in, and that's the life that you live. So again, I bring you back to something I gave you probably in volumes 1 to 4. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. That's the way it works. So November the 28th, 1920, when Jesus wants to give, he asks. Now, that might sound a contradiction, but if you look at the gospel, when Jesus wanted to feed the 5,000, he asked the apostles to give him something. They gave him 5 loaves and 2 fish. But in order to give to the crowd, he asked something from us. Now, I call that our drop of water in the wine of his redemption. He wants our participation. Because if it's all give on his side and all receiving on our side, then we're not participating. We're just consumers. We're not cooperators. We're not co-redeemers. So this is a very important message. Louisa said, "I was thinking of when my sweet Jesus, to give start to his sorrowful passion, wanted to go to his mother to ask for her blessing. And Jesus said, 'My daughter, how many things this mystery reveals. I wanted to go to my dear mother to ask for her blessing in order to give her the occasion to ask for my blessing as well. Too many were the pains that she was going to have to bear, and it was right that my blessing would strengthen her. It is my usual way that whenever I want to give, I ask. And my mother understood me immediately, so much so that she did not bless me before she asked for my blessing.'" Now notice that God wants you to ask for his blessing. instead of presuming you're going to get it. And after she was blessed by me, she blessed me herself. But this is not all. In order to create the universe, I pronounced one fiat. And by that fiat alone, I reordered and embellished heaven and earth. In creating man, my omnipotent breath infused life into him. That's Genesis 2:7. At the start of my passion, with my omnipotent and creative word, I wanted to bless my mother. But it was not her alone that I blessed. In my mother, I saw all creatures, because she was going to be constituted the mother of all creatures at the foot of the cross. She was the one who had primacy over everything. And in her, I blessed all and each one. Even more, I blessed each thought, word, act, etc. I blessed each thing that was to serve the creature. Just as when my omnipotent fiat created the sun, and this sun, without decreasing in light or heat, keeps following its course for everyone and for each of the mortals. Notice everything is for the whole lot and for each individual, because each individual is loved in the same way as the whole lot is loved. In the same way, my creative word in blessing remained in the act of blessing always, always without ever ceasing to bless, because it's done in the divine will. Just as the sun never ceases to give its light to the creatures. But this isn't all. With my blessing, I wanted to renew the qualities of creation. I wanted to call my celestial father to bless in order to communicate power to the creature. I wanted to bless her in my name and in the name of the Holy Spirit in order to communicate to her wisdom and love. Now you see the three persons, power, wisdom and love. And therefore, I wanted to renew the memory, the intellect and the will of the creature, restoring her as sovereign of everything. Now with his blessing, he wanted to restore the three great powers of the soul so that the human race could actually recover. Know, however, that in giving, I want something as well. And my dear mother understood, and she immediately blessed me, not only for herself, but in the name of all. Oh, if all could see this blessing of mine, they would feel it in the water they drink, in the fire that warms them, in the food they take, in the sorrow that afflicts them, in the moans of prayer, in the remorses of conscience, and in the abandonment of creatures. His blessing is in everything. In everything, they would hear my creative word saying to them, but unfortunately it isn't heard. I bless you in the name of the Father. I bless you in the name of myself, the Son, and I bless you in the name of the Holy Spirit. I bless you to help you. I bless you to defend you. I bless you to forgive you, and I bless you to console you. And I bless you to make you a saint. And the creature would echo my blessings by blessing me too, in everything. These are the effects of my blessing, and my church, instructed by me, echoes me, and in almost all circumstances, in the administration of sacraments and other things, she gives her blessing. I want to stop there for now.